Welcome back to Across the Aisle, hosted by the DMAC Campus Chronicle. We have two special guests with us today, actually. Another staff writer, Caleb, whose last name I cannot pronounce, so he'll jump in later with that, has joined me today to ask our very awesome guest, Auditor of State Rob Sand, today. Just a reminder, if you want to get involved in any politics on campus, there are several political clubs. I believe that the Yang Gang has recently started. I think that there are some other candidate clubs. The DMAC Democrats, of course, they meet every Wednesday, 3rd, and 4th. I don't know for sure when they meet, but I know that there's a 3 and a 4 somewhere in there. To contact Julie Szymanski, she is a great professor here, or Stacey Amling. They will be happy to give you that information. They've got some posters on their office doors as well. If you're interested in starting a conservative club on campus, Paul Bird has reached out several times and said that he'd be more than willing to start that type of club with anybody that was interested. You just have to reach out to him and get the ball rolling and go through the Student Activities Council, everything like that. All right. So, again, for refresher that people did not watch or listen, rather, to the first one with Representative Heather Mattson, this podcast, the goal of the podcast is to tackle some of the more unique positions we have in the state government and kind of relate them, basically tell you why they're important, like why they're important, what they do, what the interesting parts of our state government are. So we had Representative Heather Mattson here last time. She got to talk about what it's like to be a state representative and what the committees are like that she's on. So if you want to go back and give that one a listen, please absolutely do. It's on our Spotify, and I believe it's on also on our Apple Podcasts. So Caleb, who are you? What do you do? Last name, please.
All right. So first, I am Caleb Schlotter. I'm a student here at DMAC. I'm also a staff writer with the Chronicle, covering news stories at the Ankeny campus. I also do interviews with faculty. I write reviews and a few opinion columns here and there. Kind of all over the place, so really excited to be here with Rob Sand.
Also, my name is Bailey Perkins. I don't know if I remember said that or not. All right, Auditor Sand.
Howdy.
Hi. Yeah, who are you? What do you do?
Name's Rob Sand, born and raised in Decorah. I'm now the Auditor of State for the state of Iowa, thanks to all the folks that voted for me in 2018. And to those who didn't, it's okay. I'm your auditor, too.
I noticed that you respond very well to your critics on Twitter. You're very you're just like, let's talk about it. Like, what's your issue? Let's get lunch. Let's have a conversation why this is a point of contention for you.
Let's eat breakfast pizza, which, by the way, for everyone listening, I'm actually eating right now. they had breakfast pizza ready for me when I got here. I just think, why can't we be nice to each other? So people criticize me and troll me on Twitter, and I tend to say, oh, well, why don't we get breakfast? Why don't we get lunch? Or I just respond politely. I don't know when we decided that shouting at people was either acceptable behavior or effective behavior. I don't understand that. And I tend to think that the nicer we are to people, the nicer we feel and the happier we are. And the more vitriol and anger that we spew, the angrier we are. And I don't like being angry. I like to be happy, so there you go.
Thank you. That was awesome. Yes. So what does the state auditor do, I guess? This is probably a question you get asked probably more often than not. So what do you do for the state of Iowa?
That was actually the number one question on the campaign trail. What does the state auditor do? Short answer, financial statement audits plus public corruption investigations plus now efficiency recommendations on how to save taxpayer money. So we are the taxpayer's watchdog. And those are the three ways in which we fit that role. I had done most of the Iowa's public corruption prosecution in the Attorney General's office. And so stepping over to the auditor's office was kind of a natural fit for me because I had worked with a lot of their investigations already. And I had ideas for things that the office could do to improve their investigations. And the other piece of it was, the office has always had the authority to make efficiency recommendations as a part of its regular work, but it has never done it. They make recommendations, but not necessarily towards saving taxpayer money. And that actually got me excited because it was a chance to step into an office and be able to do something uncontroversially good, which is also nice given the state of politics. And I didn't need anyone's permission to do it. The office already had permission to do it and the authority to do it. They just hadn't been doing it historically.
So I've noticed that you've been traveling kind of around the state into the different counties and talking with county auditors across the state. And I believe this is about the actually efficiency, correct?
So for the most part, yeah.
So what are you doing when you're traveling all over the state talking to these people?
We reach out to county auditors, but we're also reaching out to the general public. I usually have a town hall. A couple of times it's been focused on Medicaid, but I think that it's important for people to be involved in their own government. So their statewide elected officials should be traveling around and should be giving them an opportunity to ask questions of them. I like to tell people you can poke me with a stick and see what comes out. I think that's important for accountability. I think it's also important for transparency. So I travel around, I tell folks what we're doing that's affecting their county specifically and their town specifically, and I also give them a general update on what else we're doing in the office, and people tend to appreciate the fact that I'm showing up.
Absolutely. So I guess a few issue-specific questions for you. You've consistently taken a tact with legal cases involving fiscal penalties incurred on state employees, ultimately paid with taxpayer funds. Can you explain why you believe the state shouldn't bear that responsibility?
It's really on a case-by-case basis. And for a couple of the cases that I've made some waves on, I've done it in a way that I think is most effective for taxpayers at the end of the day. There occasionally are cases where public employees do something that is so beyond the pale that we as taxpayers shouldn't be the ones paying for it. We should be going after that public employee and requiring them to pay for it. A great example is Dave Jamison's sexual harassment. We are paying $4 million to settle two cases, $4 million in taxpayer money. That's a lot of money. And Dave Jamison should be paying for that instead. There's a little bit of a higher standard to make the employee pay for it than what the victim needs to make the state pay for it. But that standard is met in this case. I have not talked to anyone who disagrees with that. And we are not protecting taxpayers, and we're not also preventing sexual harassment when we don't hold people personally accountable for it. We need to do those things.
A question about the LJ dinner, which you spoke at. How did you view the turnout on that, the impact of the dinner? And also, could you speak to the hashtag that you rolled out in your speech?
Oh, yeah. Look, they had a good, they had a huge crowd there. I think it's the biggest event of the primary in any state. There's never been one with 13,000 people there. And so I think that's a tough thing to organize, and I think they did a good job. As for Friendship 2020, I wasn't rolling it out. It's actually something that's been out there, and I just wanted to emphasize my support for it. I think it's important for people to focus on the idea that we can all get along even if we disagree on who our favorite candidate is. And talking about that and you know, having an opportunity for campaign staffers to get together is a good way to actually make that happen, I think.
Do you have a perspective that you'd like to share on the burden student debt has on the Iowa student population?
I think that the system that we have right now has been pretty messed up. I actually made some of my own educational choices in order to avoid debt. When I went to Iowa Law School, I went there in part because I had a full scholarship. I had turned down Harvard Law School because I knew to go there I'd have to take on a lot of debt, and I didn't want to do that. But I had good opportunities. A lot of people, to get their education, don't have the same opportunities and do need to take some debt on. We need to find a way to make sure that I think that students are able to get an education that actually pushes them forward rather than ends up holding them back. Mm-hmm. Because if you're more employable, but that job that you've just put all of your time and energy and education into gaining, you end up paying all of those benefits just back to student loans. That means you're not buying a house, you're not buying a car, you're not doing other things that contribute to your own personal life and also to the economy in a larger sense. Mm-hmm. So certainly, it's much more of a federal issue, but there needs to be reform there.
Yeah. Would you say that it's accurate that it's been about a year since you were elected?
Yeah, it would actually.
Yeah, it's November, right?
It's real close.
Yeah.
How do you view the progress that you've made in office since then?
It's actually been kind of astounding. Am I allowed to say that? Like, we have done a great job. And I don't just mean me. I give a lot of credit to the staff in our office who have been doing a great job in pushing us forward. So I campaigned essentially on three things, and we've really taken big steps on all of them. One, I wanted to have the office run in a nonpartisan way. To that end, our senior leadership team is a Democrat, an independent, and a Republican. Two, I wanted to add people with a law enforcement background to the office, because our investigations, when they're being done, are oftentimes going to end up in court. But if we want them to work in court, we need to make sure that they're being built with a courtroom in mind. And so you want to have people who know their way around a courtroom. To that end, we've created a new position, and we've hired two people to staff that position, both of whom are law enforcement professionals. So we've also kept that promise. And then the efficiency piece is the third. That's something that I really wanted to do. And to that end, we've put together our PIE initiative. PIE stands for Public Innovations and Efficiencies. And it is essentially a program that we're going to use to help cities, counties, and state agencies save money, save taxpayer money all around the state. And we're really excited about that. And we'll be sending it out here before the close of the year, which means that and then obviously we've got some Medicaid audits going as well. And so essentially everything that we talked about doing in the campaign, we've been able to accomplish in about a year.
So how did you first decide to get involved in the state government, like when you first started?
On the electoral side or Attorney General's office?
Attorney General's office, starting there and then kind of working that.
So I'm a big believer in service. And there's lots of different ways to serve. Obviously, for very good reasons, a lot of times we think first about people in armed services. And there's legitimate reasons why we hold them up highest. But we can't forget about people like public employees, teachers and other public employees who step into jobs where they are serving the public, where they might be getting a lot less money than they could get in the private sector. But they're doing it because it's something that they believe in. I knew when before I went to law school that I wanted to be in some form of public service, and I think that my 7 years as a prosecutor in the Attorney General's office were a great experience in public service for me. Every time you wake up in the morning, everything you do, everything you are filing it on behalf of the state, the people of Iowa. And I had a great experience doing that and really enjoyed having the opportunity to hold people accountable when they committed wrongs. A lot of those wrongs were against taxpayers themselves. So it was a good experience there. I think a big piece, to go back to your question, reason that I focused on it and was interested in public service is an experience that I had when I was growing up. Grew up in Decorah, as I mentioned, and I spent pretty much all of my junior and senior year working to get a skate park built in Decorah. And it's still there. If you go to the east end of town at Wold Park, you'll see it. It's not very big, but it's something that wasn't there until then. And that experience to me was very eye-opening. I worked with a little bit with the city council, but mostly with people who were just on staff at Park and Rec and figuring out what to do and how to do it. And it was a big project, but it's a boost for our hometown. And it's something there that we have now that we didn't before. And that project really made me a believer in the idea that public service is important and has value.
So going back a little bit, you mentioned that it was the step to state auditor was a logical. State auditor was a logical one for you. Why?
I had worked enough with the auditor's office to see that there were only people with one particular background in the office, only CPAs and accountants. You certainly want to have a lot of CPAs and accountants in the office. We still do. The problem, though, is when you're conducting an investigation that you think is going to end up in a courtroom, you want to have people who know what the rules of the courtroom look like and know what is going to work in a courtroom and what isn't. And there had been occasions where I had worked on cases where the auditor's office did a very logical investigation, a very quality investigation from an auditor's standpoint, but from a legal perspective, had done something that just didn't let it work in a courtroom. So the idea of moving from essentially the state's chief public corruption prosecutor to running the office that conducts the state's public corruption investigations was pretty straightforward.
So I know that you highlighted a lot in your campaign the lottery case that you broke. Can you kind of walk us through what was going on with that and the process that you went through to, I guess, crack the case?
Sure. Long story short, for those that don't know it, I ended up leading the investigation and prosecution of what turned out to be the largest lottery rigging scheme in American history while I was at the Attorney General's office. The easiest way to encapsulate what we did with that was a little bit like Dory, I guess you could say, in Finding Nemo, just keep swimming.
Yeah.
So it was just piece by piece where we had one interesting fact and we would follow that where it led us and uncover one additional interesting fact and follow that where it led us and so on and so forth through a trial that CBS this morning nationwide said I should lose, ended up winning, and then uncovering a bunch of additional lottery tickets after that that we were also able to tie back to Eddie Tipton, an insider that actually worked for the Multistate Lottery Association. His job was writing the code that was supposed to pick random numbers, and he just made it so that on average once a year, it would pick numbers that he was able to predict.
So, again, going back to kind of what you said about Medicaid, you said there were several investigations going on with Medicaid. What's going on with that?
So we've got confidentiality requirements in the office, right, meaning I can't really tell you. We do a sound an opening bell and a closing bell, but we can't do a play-by-play. What I have said publicly about one of them is we're trying to work on a compliance audit. There's a number of reasons for that. One of them is I think it's a way to look at the privatization in Medicaid and set aside the fact that it is privatized and simply ask whether it is working. I think there's a ton of people who have jumped on the privatization is always bad bandwagon, and then a roughly equal number of people who say that privatization is always good. I don't think it really adds a lot to jump on one of those bandwagons. I frankly think that if you take either of those extreme positions, you're probably further from the truth than if you actually care about the facts on each particular occasion. And I'm very much oriented towards what are the facts and how do we solve the problem, which I think requires much more interest and much more focus and much more work than just saying, you know, this is the way to do things, this is always best. So we're digging in on compliance, and the question there is fundamentally, we signed contracts as a state with these managed care organizations, these MCOs. Are we getting what we're paying for? It's a good question to ask because it gives us a much clearer example of whether or not the program is working. Even if you're an advocate for privatization, I would hope that at the end of the day, depending on what our results show, you might be willing to say, hey, you know, I like privatization, but we're not getting what we're paying for. Conversely, if you're an advocate for a state-run system, maybe at the end of the day here, you might look at our results if they are favorable and say, well, at least we're getting what we're paying for. And I think it's just a question that no one has been bothering to answer, and yet it's important for us to figure out what parts of the program are working and what parts aren't. And in order to do that, we've got to ask those questions first.
And last time when we had Heather Mattson on, she kind of talked about this because she's on the healthcare committee. She said that there wasn't really any data on if it was working or not. And is it fair to say that's what your office is currently working toward, is trying to figure out, is this working, what parts are working, and is this worth continuing to invest our taxpayer dollars into?
Precisely correct.
Okay.
to go on a lighter note here, I guess take a V-tour detour.
Mm-hmm.
I think anyone who follows you on Twitter saw that picture you took with Tommy Vitor, the guy from PodSafe.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, are you related to him?
being focused heavily on truth and integrity, I guess I don't technically know that I'm not. It is possible. We've never played that game, but I don't think so. Not that I'm aware, I'll put it that way.
This is the gentleman that, like, is your twin, right? Everybody keeps confusing you for.
People keep confusing us, and sometimes I'm confused by their confusion because I don't necessarily think that we look that much alike. Sometimes I see it, sometimes I don't.
Well, via the picture that you've shared on Twitter, it does kind of look, you look very similar, but then I saw you two kind of standing next to each other. I'm like, I don't see this. I think there's a little mm-hmm. bit of a height difference, too, I think. Mm-hmm. that. And I, you can't really tell from Twitter and from TV and obviously and all the other media coverage how tall you really are. So I think that kind of plays into tall. Like height is hard to judge.
Right.
It's like I'm literally 6'4". People don't understand that. And a lot of times people see me when I'm sitting down. So like when they'll see me standing up, they'll be talking to me, walking to me like, oh, wow, you're really tall. I'm like, yeah, I've always been this tall. You've just not noticed. So it's.
Did you see Olivia Habnick's sort of Twitter fixation with Cindy Axne's height?
I did. I
think maybe we need to start around.
Did she make a button?
She did. There's buttons. I think CYDI gives them out.
Yeah, that's an awesome idea. But her height is more remarkable than mine. Like a 6'3" guy is very tall and yet not extraordinary. I don't know how tall Cindy is, but like she's much further along the bell curve for women than I am for men.
Mm-hmm.
There's how many of those 6,000 Sydney Axneys? You did the math on that. You shared the meme.
Is that right?
Yeah.
All right.
Because it was Olivia and then Josh were doing. They were sharing memes. How many Axneys were in certain measurements? And then he replied with in a mile.
I did not see that. That's funny.
Oh, Twitter exchanges are the greatest.
For anyone who doesn't know, I'm at RobSandIA on Twitter.
Yes.
And I promise you, I'm a real human being. That about 98% of the tweets that you will see are tweets from me, and I will respond to you. In fact, I will meet you for breakfast pizza or lunch if you invite me on Twitter, within reason. If you're, I'm not going to travel to Mason City or the Quad Cities or really anywhere. If you're in Des Moines, though, then it's pretty easy. I'll do it
as long as you're in the Des Moines metropolitan area.
Right. You or can if get I breakfast. Happen to be in your city,
right?
That works too.
So. You said that these places will invite you in. How do they go about the process of inviting you in to have these efficiency conversations?
I forgot what we were talking about.
This was like the cities, at the beginning, cities? like the cities and the counties.
So all counties get an annual audit. Most cities get an annual audit. If they don't, they get a periodic exam. And so we're kind of coming anyway, or someone is coming anyway to work on that. And so. Us doing what we're doing with Pi, it's actually just an email that we send to them. They then have a PDF where they can prepare to fill out the form online. And once they prepare the PDF, they can just sit down at their computer and fill out the form and submit it. And it goes into our Microsoft form. So we don't have to spend any taxpayer resources tabulating the returns. They're just automatically fed in there.
I know you, in the past you've highlighted how great it is that your office is moving to paperless and how you're trying to talk with other state auditors from across the country and get them to also move to paperless. Mm-hmm. What are the cost benefits to that? And what are the benefits of like saving on labor with staffing?
Yeah, let me tell you. So probably day two of the office, I found out that we print and bind and then mail our reports to every one of our clients. So if our client is Mason City, and I don't know how many, but let's say that Mason City has 7 people on the city council, we would print and bind 7 copies of our audit and then mail them with postage to Mason City. I could not believe it. Sometimes it's important to have conversations before you change the way that things work. I did not have a conversation for that one. I just said, we're not doing that anymore. We're sending them an email. Couple people were like, great, it's about time. Other people were like, well, what if they want it printed out? I said, they can print it. They are adults. They can decide what they want to do with it. We are not going to waste huge amounts of resources doing this. So we used to have a 2-person department called Word Processing. They printed and bound these reports. It is now a 1-person job. The other individual left. She had been wanting to go actually to leave the office and go be a stay-at-home mom. This was actually a great opportunity because she felt like she could leave for the first time because there just wasn't that much to do. So all told, we had estimated that we had saved $11,000 to $13,000. But then when you see that Aaron also left our office, that changes that estimate to closer to $25,000 or $30,000. Which when you consider that we have an annual appropriation of only about $900,000, we're talking about 2-3% of our budget just on that alone. It's amazing to me. I'm 37, so digital native. It always blows my mind to see processes that could be done with a computer like this that aren't.
Is that a pretty common
yes.
thing that you find?
It's pretty common. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wild.
Huh. I guess kind of further in that track, what are some of the biggest issues as an auditor of state that you're trying to crack down on, so far as your purview goes?
Sure. I think our guiding lights are truth, integrity, and accountability. We want people to know what the facts are. We want them to understand that there's a source out there that they can look to that's going to lead them the right way and not mislead them. And then we want to have accountability. When people screw up, we want them to be held accountable for it. Conversely, there have been a couple circumstances where questions were being raised about whether or not something was done properly. And when we dug in and found that it was done properly, we said that. Just because we didn't find anything bad doesn't mean we shouldn't tell you what the truth still is. And so when we find good things, we will tell you about them too, because that's a part of accountability too. If someone's being criticized for something that they shouldn't be, then we want to make sure that we have the integrity to be fair with them and make sure people know what the truth is. So those are kind of our guiding lights in terms of our bigger priorities. I mean, Medicaid is a huge one because it affects so much of the state, and because in addition to that, we have undergone such a monumental revolution in the way it's administered in Iowa. There is no state in the country that privatized Medicaid so completely or so quickly. And change is hard, fast change is harder. But again, at the end of the day, what we should be curious about and what we should be working towards is figuring out what parts of it might work and what parts of it might not. And of those parts that might not, which are the worst, which are not quite as bad. I mean, those are the ways you solve problems. First, you've got to figure out your priorities. And so if we can help the governor do that, then that's a good thing. And I say the governor because ultimately, the entire program is up to the governor. Branstad snapped his fingers for privatization. That was all that needed to happen. Even if the legislature were to have a vote to say, we want to change the system to System C, that bill doesn't become law unless the governor signs it. So at the end of the day, the entire program is up to the governor, and if I can help by illustrating facts and information that help good decisions get made, then I feel like I'm doing my job.
Do you think that the party of the governor would play a role in the facts that you laid out? Do you think that if, so I guess our governor now is a Republican, so this is a good example. So you being a Democrat, if you were to lay out, these are the facts about Medicaid, this is what we found with our investigation. Do you think that you being a Democrat and the governor being a Republican would affect their decision at all?
I would hope not. I think that I say this all the time. When I first registered to vote, I registered as an independent. It wasn't soon thereafter that I registered as a Democrat because I realized that's the only way I could vote in primary elections. So I picked my poison. I don't like partisanship. I think that we have way too much focus on what someone's party is. And for me, I can tell you that what I am focused on are facts, and what I'm focused on is what's the truth. I don't want to speak for anyone else. I think other people's actions can show us what they're focused on their own. Actions tend to speak louder than words. I would hope that no matter who that information was coming from, it would be received in the same mindset, no matter someone's party.
So going off course completely here, what do you think, and this is a huge opinion question, in your opinion, what is the largest waste of taxpayer money to date?
Oh, federal, state.
Let's start federal. Let's start local, and then kind of go up to federal. Because now you brought up federal. Now I'm curious.
Wow, it's a great question. I don't know if I have a ready answer, but here's one: the fastest growing piece of the federal budget is just interest payments on the debt. Talk about a waste. We're literally just paying money for having borrowed money. We are getting nothing in return. Literally nothing. We already borrowed the money, we already spent it, and now we're just sitting there servicing the debt. That's pretty insanely wasteful.
What about Iowa's debt or the federal debt, sorry?
Federal debt.
Okay.
Iowa has a different system. We've got a 99% expenditure limitation, so we are good in Iowa on that regard. Or in that regard, I should say.
So how would you go about advising that we cut our spending at the federal level? How would you advise that we cut down on spending and start paying back a lot of this debt?
It's a great question. I, not having run for federal office, have not given it serious consideration. I do think that one of the things that we do that sort of just doesn't make any sense at all is we very heavily subsidize the fossil fuel industry. The subsidies that they receive dwarf the amount that the renewable energy sector receives. So certainly ending those would be a great way to save money and to make sure that things are priced fairly rather than just favoring the fossil fuel sector. That'd be one example of something, but it's not something that is within my purview, so I haven't given a lot of thought to it.
Now we're going to get to the lighthearted questions. Now we've dug into the hard stuff. Sure. What's your favorite part about Iowa?
Oh, Decorah, obviously.
Why do you love Decorah so much? I know that you always talk about their, like, Norwegian newspaper up to, like, what was it then?
Until 1979, yeah. They had a Norwegian newspaper. As I sit here today, I'm wearing a Norwegian sweater with a Norwegian flag on it. And I don't like Decorah because of its... I mean, I like Decorah because of its Norwegianness. That's a part of it. But just a beautiful area. If you haven't been up there, best trout fishing in the Midwest. Lots of streams that pop up all over the place. Very hilly, so really good biking, really good hiking. And they've got, you know, a number of interesting restaurants and good things going on downtown. So, plus all my family's there. So, it's just, that's definitely my favorite part of Iowa.
Why do you love our breakfast pizza so much? Sorry, specifically Casey's breakfast pizza so much.
I could eat breakfast food any meal. I'm definitely a breakfast for lunch and a breakfast for dinner kind of person. Eggs are delicious. So is sausage and bacon. I mean, how can you go wrong, right? So with breakfast pizza, it's like you get to eat breakfast food, but on pizza. That's generally speaking a little bit easier to handle. It just makes me sad that it's not available at all hours of the day, which is why I'm trying to foster a little bit of a friendly rivalry between Casey's and Come and Go to see if someone will extend their breakfast pizza hours.
Casey's. Yes, I think we would all be much happier. Like, I love Canadian bacon, and probably my go-to pizza from Casey's is like a nice Canadian bacon pizza.
Yeah.
But I love their like breakfast pizza too.
Yeah.
My problem is that my life doesn't start until like 10 in the morning. I take that back. Probably like 11 in the morning. 10:30, 11. By the time I actually get to Casey's to get my breakfast, it's just all gone. All I've got is like the bad donuts that nobody wanted, which are also good. I'm not saying that their donuts aren't also fantastic.
But still fresh.
I feel like we would all benefit from longer breakfast hours.
Yeah, we were talking about this before we started recording, and I said that their breakfast pizza hours should be less circadian normative. Just because most people wake up in the morning to start their day doesn't mean everyone does, and other people might want breakfast pizza too. What about the night shift workers, right?
Yes,
that was
exactly.
The point you made. Credit given where credit is due. That was your point.
Take heed, Casey's, at Casey's on Twitter. They follow me on Twitter, so I'll have to tweet them, tag them in this podcast, and be like, listen here, listen to the very end, and we'll talk about
Casey's.
Important
conversation about breakfast pizza.
So you had Come and Go come down to the Capitol, right? And they did like a breakfast pizza thing?
I did not have them. They chose to. Yeah,
okay,
but that was awesome. Who doesn't like free breakfast pizza?
It sounds like Come and Go is ready to rival Casey's, and Casey's just isn't stepping up. That's... We'll have to incite some...
I'm just going to be pleased to see anyone extend their breakfast pizza hours.
Anybody
for
the
people.
Let's go. But that's going to be your next...
I'm source agnostic. Whoever's providing breakfast pizza for people who get up late at noon or at 2 o'clock, that's a win for them. It's a win for those people, and it's a win for that company.
That's who we need to mobilize. We need to get some literature out to the night shift workers. Like, you
demand
need
your breakfast pizza.
We're going to do a Casey's strike.
For your breakfast at your time of
day.
Yes,
exactly.
That you wake up.
See, that's always been my question, though, is like, do night shift workers, when they wake up, do they eat, like, dinner? Do they eat breakfast? Like, is their meal schedule affected by their work? If you are a night shift worker, reach out to us. I think we're at Campus Chronicle on Twitter, DMAC Chronicle. Yeah, we're one of those two. I should probably know that. That's really bad. I was the social media editor once. Whoops. You can also email me with hate mail, fan mail. I don't care what you want to email me with. BT Perkins. Perkins like the restaurant at dmac.edu. I love to hear from people. Nobody's taking the chance to, of the five of you that listen to this podcast right now, none of you have emailed me, and I'm very disappointed in all of you.
Are there only five people listening to this?
I have no idea.
I gotta go.
I know.
Oh,
that,
wow. I actually am 8 minutes late for lunch.
Yes.
Apologies.
Yeah, sorry. We'll wrap it up there. I know.
Oh,
that,
all right.
Well, no, you made a joke and I thought it was serious. My apologies. I know our listener base is not very big. We did kind of get a bump from
It's okay.
From Heather Mattson. She came and talked to us and she retweeted us, and a lot of people listened from that, I think.
Yeah,
right. That's exactly. We have a verified Twitter user on our podcast. Come listen, please, by all means. Thank you to Rob Sand for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to come talk to us. Caleb as well for joining us, taking time out of his usual staff writing to join us. Behind the scenes, we've got Christy taking pictures. She is one of our amazing photojournalist people on the paper. A lot of the photos you see in the paper are probably her. Look at those bylines, those taglines. And we have somebody from the DMAC campus, DMAC Campus Chronicles, sorry. The DMAC DMAC Marketing Department. I'm having a hard time with words today. Yes, and I'd like to thank all the students of DMAC because it is your tuition money that funds Student Activities Council, which then in part funds a little bit of the Campus Chronicle. We really appreciate your support by reading the paper, tweeting us, tagging us in things. Send us all the memes. We love memes. When we discovered that we could airdrop to random people, we spent the entire class day like making memes about the newspaper and airdropping them to each other. So we're kind of big nerds, but we love to get memes, newspaper memes, anything you want. But again, thank you for listening. And this is us signing off.